From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore why Milwaukee's population has declined since the pandemic.
When the pandemic began, there was a real movement out of cities. Part of the deal of living in a city is, you know, you might have less personal space, but in exchange, you have access to all these great amenities. During the shutdown, those amenities weren't there, so I think quality of life really declined.
Then a Wisconsin Policy Forum report looks into how Wisconsin's restaurants and bars are recovering post-pandemic.
Although we found the numbers are higher overall in restaurants and bars, when we narrowed in to just look at bars, it looks like they're still down, and there's been a longer-term decline in the number of bars in Wisconsin.
Plus, we'll learn about a project that could connect hundreds of miles of biking and walking trails in southeast Wisconsin. All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The latest population numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau are out. The estimates show that Milwaukee's population is still shrinking, but at a slightly slower pace. The data shows the city's population fell after the pandemic, and recovery from that has yet to begin, despite Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson's ambitious goal to grow the city's population to 1 million people. To learn more about this continuous population decline, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by John Johnson, a research fellow at Marquette University's Lou Barr Center.
You recently came out with this report that looks at how population has changed in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest since the pandemic. Before we jump in, what's the data that you looked at to gather all of this information?
Yeah, I think everyone's familiar with the census that happens every 10 years when the government tries to count everybody. But, you know, that data's out of date by the time it gets released. And especially this time, the census officially took place on April 1st, 2020. And so it missed really all the changes from the pandemic. So it's really interesting to look at these annual population estimates that the Census Bureau also releases. And they get those by trying to really carefully count births, deaths, and then where people are moving. Often when you move it, you end up changing your address with some kind of federal program, the IRS, Social Security, Medicare, those kinds of things. And so pulling many different data sources together, the Census Bureau releases these population estimates as of July 1st of each year. And so the most recent numbers are as of July 1st, 2023, measuring the change that occurred between July 1st, 2022 and 2023.
So what stood out to me from your report is that Milwaukee County's population continues to decline. You note that it's a slower decline compared to recent years, but it's still shrinking at twice the rate of the 2010s. Can you help explain that shift?
Yeah, the city's population and the county's population, I believe, have fallen in every census beginning in 1970. We think the city was actually growing from the mid-aughts, so like, you know, like 2005-ish through the early 2010s. But when you look at those 10-year benchmarks, it's been declining consistently. And that was true from 2010 to 2020, although actually the census showed that the number of occupied housing units grew by about 5,000, but the city's population fell by about 17,000 from 2010 to 2020 because household size shrank. Then when the pandemic hit, that really hammered cities across the country, and particularly Milwaukee. The population of the city shrank a lot in that first year of the pandemic, and then a little bit less the year after, but then it was still shrinking in 2023, even as other parts of the country were beginning to recover.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm wondering, is there anything that can help explain that shift?
Well, I think several factors. When the pandemic began, there was a real movement out of cities, I think, for easy to understand reasons. You know, people wanted more space. Part of the deal of living in a city is, you know, you might have less personal space, a smaller apartment or a smaller house, but in exchange, you have access to all these great amenities. During the shutdown, those amenities weren't there. So I think quality of life really declined in cities for a lot of people. And then also in Milwaukee, we had three really bad years where we set sequential record numbers for murders in the city. And I think it's no surprise that, you know, encouraged some people to leave.
So basically what I'm hearing from what you're explaining to me is that Milwaukee County is seeing more births than deaths, but more people are choosing to move away. Is this true for the city of Milwaukee, too?
Yes, and it's more true for the city than it is for the county as a whole.
Interesting.
So, yeah, the suburbs have a little bit of a different thing going on.
Yeah, tell me about what the population is going on in the suburbs, like Oak Creek, maybe.
Yeah, Oak Creek is growing, and it's growing in large part by adding more housing units and having more people move there. I think it also has a pretty strong birth rate as well, although that data is a little bit harder to get. Milwaukee City, on the other hand, has this relatively strong birth rate, but more people leave than move here, as you said. Although it's worth pointing out that the birth rate in Milwaukee has been declining. The number of births to mothers in the city has been going down over the last decade or so, and that decline accelerated during the pandemic, whereas the trend in the suburbs has been more flat. So the number of babies being born in the Milwaukee County suburbs has stayed pretty level over the last couple decades. Consequently, the share of babies being born in the county has actually shifted towards the suburbs, even though the majority are still born within city limits.
So less people are having kids and moving away?
Yes, both of those things.
So I guess I'm curious, what about rural areas? I feel like sometimes the story is people are leaving rural places. What's going on over there?
Yeah, it varies between the states in an interesting way. Rural Illinois is really getting slammed. There are a lot of places in rural Illinois that have more deaths than births and more people leaving than coming there, which is really kind of a double whammy that's hard to recover from. If you look in rural Wisconsin, there's actually this, to me, fascinating band of population growth from northern Michigan through northern Wisconsin and into northern Minnesota, really the sort of Northwoods area. And what we see is that, you know, the population is pretty old up there, so there's actually more deaths than births in most places. But over the last few years, there's been a pronounced increase in migration to those counties, mostly domestic migration, people moving from somewhere else in the United States to there to live. And I wonder if some of that is remote work allowing people who maybe have wanted the kind of lifestyle you can have in northern Wisconsin, which is very pleasant in a lot of ways, but didn't have a job that would let them move there beforehand. That's some speculation on my part. We'll get, you know, the sort of data that lets us measure that better in the future. But certainly the population trends we've seen since the pandemic are consistent with that.
That's really interesting. So why I especially found your report interesting is that I'm fairly new here to Milwaukee. And as an outsider coming in, the city kind of feels like it's growing. Can this feeling be true of like, it feels like it's growing, but it's shrinking?
Milwaukee is so big, by which I mean geographically spread out. There's still cornfields in the city of Milwaukee, like actual commodity corn that they're growing. The annexation spree that the city went through in the 1950s was enormous. And so if you're in some of the parts of the city along the lake or near downtown, you do get a real sense of growth. You see cranes and buildings coming up and new apartment buildings. And those areas are growing. Their population is higher than it was 20 years ago. But, you know, somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of all the houses in Milwaukee are ranch homes. You might not realize that if you're downtown, you basically never see a ranch house, but there's these great swaths of the city out towards the southwestern and northwestern peripheries where the kinds of housing are much different, whereas household size declines, total population declines with it, even as the houses remain fully occupied. And then you have this about a quarter of the city, maybe a fifth, on the nearer north side, where lots of the social determinants of health, so to speak, are pretty negative, where, you know, there's a lot of lead poisoning, a lot of crime, a lot of predatory landlords. And when people get the opportunity to leave those places, they often do, and they're not replaced. And so we've seen really dramatic declines in the population in those parts of the city. So there's several things going on at once. You have these places where we're adding housing units and the population is going up. You have places that are desirable to live in, but because there's not a lot of room to add more apartment buildings, the population is slowly declining as household size declines. You have this part of the city where the population is declining because people move out and aren't replaced in net terms. And then there's actually this part of the city where the population has grown in recent years because of growing household size, which is unusual and mostly happens in places with a lot of immigrants. So there's parts of the near south side where we've seen that happen.
And so I'm thinking we're seeing the story play out of Milwaukee shrinking. But the mayor, when he was running to become Milwaukee's mayor in 2022, Cavalier Johnson, said he wants the city's population to grow to 1 million people. But we're far from that. So I wonder, can the city government actually do that? Like, what power do they have over population change?
Right. I think, fortunately, this is America. The government can't make you move to Milwaukee. They can't make you have more kids. So, you know, there's limits. And I applaud the mayor's enthusiasm for Milwaukee. And I think there's strong reasons to want the city to grow. Namely, the city was built for a lot more people. And so we have this sort of built environment and fixed infrastructure that right now fewer of us are having to pay for. And so actually it helps us sort of shoulder the burden of the infrastructure we've got to have more people living here. The mayor's efforts to grow the population that I've seen thus far are the sorts of things that will bear fruit over the longer term. He's focused a lot to date on trying to get the reckless driving problem in the city under control, particularly through changing the design of streets to encourage safer driving and to make it safe for people to get around in ways that aren't driving. And that's a quality of life change that I think can make the city more attractive in its way. He's currently promoting a change to the zoning code, which would make it easier to build accessory dwelling units and small apartment buildings around the city, which could have the effect of increasing the housing supply in some of these popular neighborhoods where there aren't a lot of empty lots currently. That proposal, I believe, will be voted on by the Common Council later this year. I think it's a great idea, honestly, and could make some real changes in the city over time, but it's not the new policy yet. And the mayor's also begun talking this year about needing to improve the quality of education that's in the city, because when you talk to especially young families, you see that that's a big concern for them, is the quality of education. And in fact, you can kind of measure that effect by looking at the number of babies that are born in the city in a given year, and then seeing what the enrollment in first grade is 6 years later. So I've looked at this across all sectors, district schools, charter schools, private schools, and you see about a 19% drop in the number of kids going on to enroll in first grade compared to birth. So that means that nearly a fifth of young families are choosing to move out of the city after their child is born and before they enroll in school.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that's sort of a group of people you can look at and be like, okay, why are they leaving? How do we make the city more attractive for them to stay in. Part of that is education. Part of that is providing the sort of housing that they want to live in, quality of life issues. And I think we see that those are top of mind for this mayoral administration.
So what else can be done to bring people to Milwaukee, but also keep them here, like you mentioned?
Provide the kind of housing that will increase the population in the neighborhoods that people want to live in. So, you know, we see neighborhoods where housing prices go up because housing is scarce, and we see other neighborhoods where as we build new housing units, they fill up. I don't think there's a single place in the city where we've added a lot of housing units and have high vacancy rates. Anytime we build more housing, people move into those units. And I sometimes hear people say, like, why are we only building these one-bedroom apartments or studios, these small kinds of places? And the reason is that even as we've built a lot of those small apartment buildings, the city has added one-person households much faster than we've been able to build those. So the demand is actually there. There's a lot of people living by themselves who, as best we can tell, will choose a smaller place to live in a neighborhood that they want to live in, given the choice to do so. So I think there's a supply issue and then also this quality of life issue we've discussed, the parts of the city that it's difficult to have a safe, healthy lifestyle. And so people often leave when they're able to.
Before we wrap up, I want to point out that your report shows that Madison is a growing city. So more births than deaths, and people are coming in. What can Milwaukee learn from a growing city like Madison?
Well, we should get the state capitol to move here and maybe the flagship state university as well. No, Madison has benefited from those two things enormously. But we do have a large state university here in the form of UWM and some other great private schools. And I think there's a role to play in encouraging more entrepreneurship from the people who graduate from those schools. Madison has hit some home runs with businesses that have started there and gone on to employ a lot of people. And then the other thing that Madison has done successfully, although not without causing some contention within the city, is building a lot more housing. They've built a ton of housing in Madison to accommodate the demand to live there. And that's the number one reason why their population has been able to grow so much.
Hmm. Well, John, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate you sharing your insight with me and making sense of Milwaukee's population.
My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. He spoke with Like Effects expert Nunez. You can hear more of this conversation at WUWM.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a project that aims to expand access to Milwaukee's hiking and biking trails. But first, we'll learn how much Wisconsin's bars and restaurants have recovered post-COVID and what challenges remain. That's coming up on Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As we move into summer, it's turning into peak restaurant and bar season. Perhaps you've been going out to these places more, but have still noticed the changes many establishments have made and kept since the COVID-19 pandemic. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows that recovery largely continues for the state's food and bar scene, both for employment and sales. There are, however, some lingering impacts from the pandemic, as many establishments keep reduced hours and some still struggle to attract and keep workers. To share more insight about the report, I'm joined by Wisconsin Policy Forum senior researcher Joe Pietrangelo. Joe, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So the Wisconsin Policy Forum did an assessment of Wisconsin's restaurants and bars back in 2021, and you found at that time it was rebounding overall, but the employee numbers remained down. So we have an updated report on that. So what's the general picture looking like for Wisconsin?
So overall, we're seeing a number of positive indicators, including employment being back basically to where it was at prior to the pandemic, and more overall restaurants operating in Wisconsin than before the pandemic. So those are some very positive indicators.
We're talking data here. Can you briefly go over where your data sources were coming from?
Yeah, a lot of it came from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. So all of our information about employment and the number of establishments came from them. We also looked at the state's data on tax revenues to see how sales were going for restaurants and bars, and that came from the Department of Revenue.
Great. So in addition to these data sources, you also conducted interviews with leaders of Wisconsin's restaurant and bar industries to provide more context. So were there any major points of either optimism or remaining concerns among these leaders?
Yeah. So first of all, when talking to the Restaurant Association, one thing that they pointed out was that some restaurants are experiencing more challenges still than others. And they specifically pointed to the mid-priced sit-down restaurants that are more influenced by higher prices. We've all experienced higher prices when we go out to eat. And according to the Restaurant Association, the higher end restaurants don't suffer as much from that because their clients have more disposable income. And then the most inexpensive restaurants also don't have as many challenges because they're lower cost and people even might be shifting down from a mid-price place to a lower price place. And so they said that those ongoing challenges are still more in the mid-price places, as well as downtown restaurants that rely on a lunch crowd. Still some lingering effects from, you know, the shift to more remote and hybrid work. Then the Bar Association, I should say the Tavern League, in Wisconsin, I spoke to them as well. They said that attracting and retaining employees is still a big challenge for many, many bars in Wisconsin. We found when we looked at the data on the number of businesses, although we found the numbers are higher overall in restaurants and bars, when we narrowed in to just look at bars, it looks like they're still down, and there's been a longer term decline in the number of bars in Wisconsin. We actually found about 20% fewer bars in Wisconsin in 2022 compared to 2003. So a big decline. And so we wanted to ask the Tavern League about that. They said that a big factor in that is a loss in small family-owned bars. So many of those are in smaller towns where, you know, there wasn't a next generation or somebody who wanted to take it on and keep it going.
So not necessarily due to a shift in, say, consumer habits at small
bars. Exactly. Which, you know, we looked into because I wanted to see how employment had shifted. And employment is down slightly in bars, but much less so than the number of bars. So there's more been a shift to fewer establishments with as many employees, not a reduction in consumption.
Okay. Now, talking about staffing especially, and of course the wages that go along with this data factor, during the pandemic, wages did increase at a faster rate for restaurant workers, but your report shows those increases have slowed quite a bit. So can you share some of the factors that contribute to this?
Yeah, so I think, demand for restaurant workers was very high during the pandemic. It was hard to attract and retain them. It's still a factor, as we pointed out, but that drove some of the increases in wages. And like you said, we saw big increases. We looked actually last year at the relative wages in different occupations and found that they had increased faster for restaurant workers than any other occupational group, much faster than inflation. But then for this study, when we looked at just the last year, the shift over the last year, the wage increases were very similar to the increases across all jobs. So it was no longer faster wage increase for restaurant workers. That could be because the demand for workers has eased a bit or quite a bit. We were seeing just skyrocketing numbers of job openings in the middle of the pandemic and later in the pandemic. That has gone down, at least when we look at national data. Those job openings have gone down quite a bit, where they're still maybe a little bit elevated, but they're closer to where they were at before the pandemic.
So with the factors of going into things evening out, the increase we see on our menus, it all intersects with inflation, supply, and menu pricing. And your data shows that restaurants are earning a similar amount of pre-pandemic revenue, but yet it's on a lower number of transactions. So at first glance, this is kind of counterintuitive, right? So can you explain this concept a bit more and what restaurants are actually doing in their methods of operation?
Yeah. So basically what we found is that their revenues overall for restaurants and bars has returned essentially to the pre-pandemic trend line, though it is a little bit lower when you factor in inflation. And so what we know is that many restaurants and bars have shifted their schedules a little bit. You see some places are not open quite as many days, or they've shortened their hours a little bit. And one thing that we heard when we spoke with, again, the Restaurant Association of the Bar and the Tavern League, are that many businesses found during the pandemic that they could have a similar bottom line with a little bit reduced operations. So they're focusing really on the days and hours that they can make the most bang for their buck and have a staff that is appropriate to the demand that they have as a business. We also got a little bit increase in the number of businesses. So all this kind of factors in to the numbers. But yeah, I think that our takeaway is that it's likely a little bit fewer sales are happening to earn the revenue that, you know, is pretty much getting close to being back on track. So that's kind of factoring into it as well.
So we've kind of touched upon it, but how have consumers been impacted by all of these rebounds and changes since COVID?
Yeah, we're all familiar with higher prices now. It was quite an adjustment at first. I think the positive news for consumers is that although prices have gone up quite a bit, those increases have slowed quite a bit. And they're basically down to levels that we were more used to before the pandemic. They're not increasing very rapidly anymore. So we have some national data from the National Restaurant Association that found year-over-year menu prices for restaurants was as high as 9% during the height of the pandemic, and that's down to around 3% as of the most recent data we have. We also found the Midwest, the prices had risen more slowly than they had nationally. So, and some of the factors going into the more stable prices are that the wages are not increasing as quickly as they were before. Some of the supply chain issues that were impacting restaurants getting the supplies they needed have eased, as well as wholesale food prices that factor into the costs of everything that restaurants make. Those have also eased. So all those factors are positive from a consumer perspective because we're not likely to see quickly increasing prices in the near future.
So overall, according to your report, restaurants and bars seem to be doing okay, but it's still kind of a mixed bag with not a ton of predictability. Do you think that both as consumers and as people who may work in these spaces, do we kind of have different expectations of each other until it evens out more, ideally? I mean, we only have the data thus far, right? But
right.
I think we're still kind of treading differently and kind of accepting different modes of operation.
I think that's a really good way of putting it. I think people have started to adjust to it on both sides, but there's still adjustments happening. I think restaurants are still figuring out, you know, their plan and whether they're going to continue to shift to, you know, being open more than they were during the pandemic. Consumers have started to get used to the new normal with restaurant prices, but that's still ongoing. People are still returning to restaurants. So yeah, I think it's just an evolving situation still, and one that we'll continue to track. Restaurants and the arts were the two industries that were so heavily impacted by the pandemic and are two that we've been really keeping a close eye on.
Definitely. And thank you, Joe, for joining me today to talk more about this sector in particular. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined me to talk about their recent report, Recovery Continues for Restaurants and Bars. You can find a link to the full report, as well as our other conversations with the Wisconsin Policy Forum at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then hear from a group advocating for better hiking and biking trails throughout southeast Wisconsin. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee has two major recreational trail projects either underway or under discussion. Underway is the Route of the Badger, which will connect hundreds of miles of trails in southeast Wisconsin. Under discussion is a proposed trail going from American Family Field to the far north side of the city along the 30th Street Industrial Corridor. The Rails to Trails Conservancy held its board meeting in Milwaukee last week to advocate for these projects. That's when Conservancy President Ryan Chow spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach.
Milwaukee and Wisconsin has a really strong bike culture, a strong understanding and appreciation of the values of trails, walking, and biking. And that's something I've heard from folks has really grown in the last few years as particular leaders and advocates have focused on connecting many of Milwaukee's great trails into a cohesive system. And that's called the Route of the Badger project. Ultimately, it would be 700 miles of connected trails throughout Milwaukee and southeast Wisconsin. Currently, there are 300 miles of trails in the system, which is just amazing in terms of what that's doing for the community. And ultimately, that's what interests us most, is providing safe, protected infrastructure that allows people to use trails as part of their everyday life and have trails accessible for everyone.
A lot of agencies, a lot of organizations promote equity and diversity, and what's your group trying to promote either in Milwaukee or nationwide as far as expanding diversity of people using bikes, especially on trails?
Yeah, so using trails is one of the lowest barrier ways to get active and be outdoors. And we found that especially places that have connected trails, that the use of those trails goes up 40 to 80%. So it's a great way to be active and really take care of your physical and mental health. Yet there are still disparities when it comes to the use of those trails and where they're located. So we're deeply committed to supporting communities to essentially have trails as equally accessible anywhere in a particular city and region. And a great example is here in Milwaukee, where our work with all the other partners in the Route of the Badger is prioritizing a very important connected trail component, which is the 30th Street Industrial Corridor. And that is essentially a below-grade rail line that goes from the baseball field where the Brewers play up to Haven Woods. And right now it is an underutilized corridor that is in some form of neglect, but has a huge potential when you can co-locate a trail there next to the rail line, provide access to it, not only to then unlock the convenience of outdoor activity, but really revitalize and connect that community.
So what conversations can you tell me about that you've had in Milwaukee to try to unlock some more funding or rights of way or anything more to push the effort along?
Yeah, so we have a few different roles we play. And so one of them is national federal advocacy. So a big part of what we do is to work with members of Congress and work on the Hill to unlock more federal funding for trails for all across the country. And we're proud to have been part of a coalition to have some big wins in the last infrastructure bill, the bipartisan infrastructure law, where we essentially, with partners, were able to double federal funding for trails, dedicated funding for trails. At the same time, we've seen just this prioritization with investing not just dedicated funding, but funding that can support all different forms of infrastructure, prioritizing trails, walking, and biking as that form of investment. And so what we see here in Wisconsin is just real excitement about those resources, how they can be put to use, how they can be complemented with state and foundation funding to really accelerate progress on projects that, you know, take a while and have really been awaiting this kind of investment.
Could there be additional corporate support for this 30th Street Trail? Could there be additional foundation? Is it an all hands on deck, if you will, or all funders on deck?
Absolutely, yeah. So I would say the public funding is essential and vital, and I think that's really available more now than ever. But I think for any kind of complex project like this, you need all different forms of public and private investment. And some of that is that many of the public programs require a match, another funder to come in and support that. And so we've seen in places we've worked, like in Cleveland and Philadelphia, foundations come and be that early money in to then leverage the public funding, and for those foundation and corporate leaders to really serve as kind of civic leaders, bringing people together and providing a form of convening power that then really the broader community can join.
So I think you took a bus tour as well. What would you say is your level of optimism on this 30th Street corridor? That's going to get done in the near future?
Really high. My optimism is really high. I would say, for one, while it's going to be a real vital asset for the community, it's important that we aren't trying to just rush every step. So in many ways, the partners have been deliberate in the recent years to form really strong reciprocal partnerships, moving at the speed of trust. And the reason that's so important is that the trail is one part of investment in the community, but it can really spur other forms of investment, housing, economic development, other valuable assets. So one, I think it's important that the community moves at a pace that really takes full advantage of this. And I think with those partnerships really solidified and more funding available than ever before, you've got in many ways things lining up that have both the generate the political will and simply the investment that I think for us couldn't be syncing up better than they are.
What else did you notice bike trail-wise or recreational trail-wise on your bus tour? What other impressions did you come away with for the Milwaukee area?
Well, I've been fortunate to have gotten to know Milwaukee a bit in recent years. So for me, it was actually, and I said this earlier, that for some strange reason, I've been coming here for years, and I always come in the winter. So just to have sunshine and just to see green while touring these trails was with its own particular joy. But for many of our board members, this was the first time they were visiting. And what were things I think that struck us? One was that how prevalent trails were throughout Milwaukee, that you saw them in all different forms, from along the lake shore, really kind of in a public park setting, to take the beer line, which is really taking advantage of infrastructure that was used for transportation. So I think that was a big one, was just if you want a connected trail network, you need to really serve all different types of communities and be pretty darn creative in how you add those gap closures in places that weren't necessarily first designed to accommodate this kind of infrastructure. In addition to what we saw physically, and whether that was touring or having a celebration we called Grillin' and Chillin' later, I've had this feeling and heard this from board members, just how strong and close-knit and supportive this community is, how deep the relationships are, and really, in many ways, I think for me, this idea that people here both are passionate about biking, also passionate about this city, and wanting this city to really be in many ways on the forefront for just what it means to have a bikeable, human scale place to live.
You mentioned earlier Route of the Badger and there's ways to go on it. How would you characterize the challenges to completing it, and are they typical challenges that you have seen in other communities, Philadelphia or wherever, to expand these regional networks? Are the hurdles the same?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the keys for success would be, one, you need strong, tenacious advocacy, you need the investment and the resources, and you need the kind of committed civic and political leaders. And so I would say what has us optimistic is you see those kind of elements in place lining up more and more. So I think the ingredients are there. I'd say those at the same time can be the obstacles, right? It's essentially leveraging the kind of resources to put in all the hard work to build and close gaps. And it's really, I think, moving with communities at a point where they're really fully on board and ready to embrace out of a new form of infrastructure that didn't exist before.
How would you characterize cooperation from railroads here and elsewhere that still own active track? We hear that occasionally in discussions of the 30th Street Corridor. What did you come away with the future of getting along with the railroads?
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of potential. I mean, honestly, I think in these kinds of projects and programs, there are often a lot of different kind of interests and ambitions. So I think there's work to be done to fully align those. But I think the thing that, you know, we are confident in is that, say, the 30th Street Corridor, it's co-locating a trail alongside a rail line. There is overwhelming evidence that in fact is a safe solution, and in many ways a safer solution than not having kind of a built out, developed pathway and trail alongside even a, you know, infrequently used corridor. So I think very much it's about just continued education and building understanding and finding those kind of points of common interest and alignment, whether it's with the railroads here or just all the other many players from different sectors.
How might it be safer to have a trail along a railroad track? Is it people don't try to cross in front of trains and otherwise, or how would you characterize it?
It's exactly that. I mean, I think it's a couple things. Is that when you then have a thoughtfully planned and designed trail where rail might be a part of it, is you then really, you plan for all the ways that you get over the tracks where you need to. You know, then calls for bridges, it calls for tunnels. You build in all that infrastructure so that then that trail can fully find its way through. And then just where a trail is alongside a rail, it's exactly what you said. There's kind of, there in some ways are those clear rules, unstated rules. Like here's where the train goes, here's where people and bikes go. And there's not kind of the lack of clarity or temptation to do other than now this wonderful, safe thing that's been built for you.
Ryan Chow is the president of the Rails to Trails Conservancy. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. dinosaurs are thought to have dominated the Earth for more than 150 million years. We're still learning so much about how they lived and what caused them to start dying off. But what has become clear is they never truly left. Dr. Jingmei O'Connor is the Associate Curator for Fossil Reptiles at the Field Museum in Chicago. O'Connor joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2022. Dr. Jingmei O'Connor is the Associate Curator for Fossil Reptiles at the Field Museum in Chicago. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2022.
Is it fair to say that birds are essentially dinosaurs?
Yes, 100% birds are living dinosaurs. So all of us, when we've looked out the window and seen a bird fly by, we are literally seeing dinosaurs alive today.
It's a little crazy thinking about that, in part because as I was going through my notes preparing for this interview, this is a theory that was posited a really long time ago and a long time before it was accepted. What was the turning point where people started to see that straight line between dinosaurs and birds?
I think the reason that this idea took so long to be fully accepted is two reasons. One is that there was very limited evidence when this idea was first proposed, like over 150 years ago. And it was this new evidence that came to light in the 1990s that provided tangible, irrefutable evidence that birds are, in fact, a living lineage of dinosaurs. And I think the other reason that it's been really difficult and why there are still a few holdouts within the scientific community is simply because it's so difficult for us to wrap our minds around the idea that dinosaurs are still alive. We've been taught over and over and over again, dinosaurs are extinct, but they're not. In fact, there's more species of birds now than there are species of mammals. So dinosaurs are alive and well. And I think that's just a really difficult concept for people to grasp sometimes.
One of the things that I think is difficult for people is this idea that dinosaurs, many, probably had feathers. And we have this picture in our minds of, you know, these scaly, I don't want to say lizard-like, but more reptilian than bird-like, these scaly animals that now we're having to reimagine with feathers.
Yeah, well, so birds are dinosaurs and dinosaurs are reptiles, right? So that is another thing that we were all taught, that there's mammals, reptiles, and birds. But in fact, now we know birds are a group of reptiles. Now, in terms of which dinosaurs are feathered, you don't have to feather them all. The feathers that we see in living birds are a very derived characteristic. So this means it's a very complex structure that evolved only in one lineage of dinosaurs. Now, it does seem that the primitive condition in dinosaurs, and also in the common ancestor between dinosaurs and pterosaurs, which are these other flying reptiles that often get lumped with dinosaurs, but are in fact not dinosaurs, their common ancestor had what we call proto-feathers. So they are the evolutionary beginning of what will eventually become the complex feather we see in living birds. So we see these features in pterosaurs and also in some dinosaurs, but big dinosaurs like the long-necked sauropods, they were completely covered in scales. But when you move into theropod dinosaurs, which are your bipedal carnivorous dinosaurs like Sue the T-Rex or Deinonychus, and as you evolve through these dinosaurs into the groups that are more and more closely related to birds, you start to see more and more feathers and more complex feather structures until you eventually evolve this modern feather that we see in living birds that has that central spine that we call the rachis, and it has these barbs sticking off either side that you can pull apart and then like zip back together. So that type of feather had to evolve before you could then evolve them into overlapping structures to form a wing that can then be used to fly, which is, of course, one of the major characteristics that we associate with avian dinosaurs.
This idea of dinosaurs flying, we do have, of course, a section that I think the general public will go, okay, yes, yeah, some dinosaurs flew, but that group may be much larger than we once believed.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing that we're first still trying to get people to really understand is that birds are flying dinosaurs. But one of the newest and most exciting things that we have discovered in paleontology just within the past 5 years is that birds were not the only flying dinosaurs. So we actually still don't know which group of dinosaurs, non-avian dinosaurs, birds are most closely related to. We think maybe it's troodontids, but we don't really know. And one of the reasons why it was really difficult for us to try to figure out which group of dinosaurs then evolved into birds was because actually a lot of dinosaurs were evolving flight, and things that we think of as an avian characteristic is actually better referred to as a aerodynamic characteristic. So we would look at these dinosaurs and be like, that is a bird-like feature. Now we know that that dinosaur has bird-like features because it is also flying, but it evolved flight independent of the avian lineage. So flight evolved at least 4 times in dinosaurs, all roughly around the same time, between 165 and 120 million years ago. I mean, it's just really crazy to think about all these different dinosaurs with different types of wings flying in different ways, kind of like the diversity of flying mammals that we see today, where you have bats with powered flight, but you also have things like flying squirrels and many other animals, mammals that use gliding flight. So the same diversity was present in dinosaurs.
So this is an odd theory that I came upon while researching for this conversation. This theory suggests that the T-Rex's most distinguishing feature, or at least one of them, the tiny arms, may not have been arms at all, but wings. Is there evidence to actually support that?
Yeah, definitely not. But the wing, if you feathers arranged on the arm, forming a structure that looks like a wing, this is something that evolved in dinosaurs for another purpose. We don't really know what. And then evolution hijacked this feature and used it for flight multiple times in these different flying dinosaurs. But when you look at the earliest arms with these wing-like feathers, you can see that the proportions of the arms relative to the body is, you know, definitely tells you the animal's not flying. Basically, they have really tiny arms and really long legs. So the surface area formed by that proto-wing cannot generate enough lift to make the animal that is that size airborne. So that is one reason that I would say, based just on the skeletal proportions of T-Rex, there's no way you could ever say that's a wing. But beyond that, this derived feather that I keep talking about with what we call a pinnaceous feather, the type of feather you see in living birds, that feather had not evolved in the Tyrannosaurus grade of theropod evolution. So we do know that relatives of T-Rex had proto feathers, but they definitely did not have this advanced pinnaceous feather morphotype, which then allows you to overlap and make these big structures. So if T-Rex had feathers, which is controversial, I think it did, it had proto feathers, but they would have just been like fuzzy bristles that probably maybe were only along its back, forming kind of like a spiky crest that might have been used for attracting mates or something like that. But definitely we can rule out wings.
All right. So no giant T-Rex terrorizing the skies of our ancient world.
No, yeah. Well, living with T-Rex, you did have the biggest flying organisms of all time, a member of this pterosaur lineage, Quetzalcoatlus, that was the size of like a Cessna, like a small plane. And that would have been flying over the heads of T-Rex.
Very interesting. So understanding that birds really are a kind of dinosaur, what kind of insight does that give us into dinosaurs more generally?
Well, it allows us to use birds as what we call extant analogs, basically living analogs, to understand better the biology of extinct dinosaurs. So we can dissect birds and we can look at their metabolic rates and we can look at the way they breathe and the way they digest. And it can help us to better understand what dinosaurs were like when they were alive. And I think that's something that's really important and really kind of revolutionary. And if you think about birds and you look at them and the way that they move, you know, their head moves so fast. And I mean, honestly, they kind of scare me when you really look at a bird and it's looking at you. And then you imagine, you know, a T-Rex like that, which we actually know that it had a brain that allowed it to track movement, like with its eyes very quickly, the same way we see in living birds. Actually, T-Rex had vision better than an eagle. All these, you know, biological aspects of these extinct animals that we can extract from looking at living dinosaurs that helps us bring these extinct dinosaurs to life. actually makes them even more terrifying, if you ask me. And so I definitely have a more than a decent dose of fear when it comes to birds.
Jingmei, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Joy.
Dr. Jingmei O'Connor is the Associate Curator for Fossil Reptiles at the Field Museum in Chicago. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2022. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll examine the case against Crystal Kaiser, a woman who killed the man who was sex trafficking her when she was a teenager. Plus, we'll tell you about a group of queer artists formed in Milwaukee in the 1970s called Les Petites Bonbons and how they rose to international fame. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.